Chapter 2. August 4th, 1914, Belgium. Great Britain declares war on Germany. Declaration last night after Kaiser's unsatisfactory reply to British ultimatum. Belgium must be kept neutral. Daily Messenger. They were told to pack one bag each.
Now then, girls, come on, hurry. Your father said we must be quick.
But, Mama, why isn't Papa packing a bag? And where are we going?
Eleanor DeWitt, 10 years of age, pressed her mother.
Questions, questions, questions. We're in a hurry, Linny.
Charlotte DeWitt pulled open a drawer and took out a pouch containing identity documents.
I'll hold on to these. We can't lose them.
But where are we going?
Asked Cecily, Eleanor's older sister.
To see Nana in England, and we must get to the port before all the boats go without us.
Will Papa fight the Germans, Mama?
Eleanor dropped her school cardigan into a cloth bag.
And what about Polo?
Polo will stay here with Papa as soon as he gets back. Papa says we can't take the dog with us.
When will we come home?
Asked Cecily.
Cecily DeWitt, stop asking questions. Set an example for your sister. When he went out, Papa said we have not 20 minutes to catch a train to the coast, and it might be the last. Those minutes are ticking by, so hurry.
The two girls followed their mother's instructions, moving closer together as they finished packing their bags. There was one more task. Charlotte came from the bedroom she shared with her husband. She was clutching 2 cotton petticoats.
Slip on another petticoat, each under your skirts.
But I already...
Ceci,
not now. I don't care if you are wearing 10 petticoats. Please put this one on, and don't take it off until we arrive at Nana's. Now then, pull together. Don't make me wish I had sons.
Just as well. They'd be at the front by now.
Eleanor's eyes widened. In a flash, her mother's hand thrashed across Cecily's face. Tears flooded both their cheeks as Charlotte DeWitt reached for her daughter, weeping.
Oh, my darling, I am so sorry, so, so sorry. That was unforgivable. I'm just so, so... It doesn't matter what I am. That was terrible of me. I'm so sorry. But please, Cecily, do as I say. We must leave now.
The train rumbled at a slow pace, stopping at almost every station and several more unscheduled halts until the locomotive could go no farther. No one knew the reason for the terminated journey, but they walked the final stretch into the port at Ostend. They had no idea how many kilometres they had trudged as they followed the weary trail of people seeking safe harbour from the Kaiser's invading army. Once at the port, they waited and waited. Eleanor's ankles ached and she was tired, her legs throbbing because her mother had made her wear thick, lace-up boots. They were hard to pack and no one could afford to leave good leather boots behind, boots that would be needed in winter. She was wearing several petticoats underneath a woolen skirt, and she was tempted to remove one or two and stash them behind a wall or give them to someone, but she knew the final petticoat was special. She had felt tiny bumps along the seams as she pulled it on, tying the ribbon around her waist to secure it, making sure it would never fall below her skirt. Her mother was adamant about letting no one see the pretty white petticoat.
"Don't let snow fall in the south," Charlotte had warned.
Eleanor knew they were perhaps carrying a few diamonds each and some folding currency. They stood in the long line, a queue that moved at a sluggish pace, in time as fractious children settled and the earlier earnest chatter descended into silence. Word ran along the line. No more boats. No more evacuation. No more chance to cross the English Channel to safety. They would have to remain. They would have to return to their homes, to a life changed, as if the footwear worn by each man, woman, and child were encased in concrete. They were now prisoners in their own country, unable to escape a land with declared neutrality that was now at war with an occupying army marching into every town, every community. A few scuffles broke out as the line of desperate humanity snaked back toward their villages, but the skirmishes were soon settled. People, after all, had to stick together. Children were picked up and carried, then when arms wearied they were passed to rested hands or set down to stumble along on tired legs or placed atop push-barrows. Cecily and their mother argued. Eleanor wished they would both just be quiet. A year earlier she had heard Charlotte telling their father that Cecily was entering that age, and it wouldn't be long before Eleanor was voicing strident opinions and becoming argumentative along with her sister. The father had laughed. "Give me strong young women folk with sharp elbows, Charlotte, my dear, and they will make a good account of themselves in this world." Eleanor had wondered then what a woman might need to do to make a good account of herself. How long did it take to reach the house? The home Eleanor thought they would never see again. The DeWitt women had lost count of the days, but they were home, yet without Thomas, a 42-year-old man who they wanted to believe was now wearing the uniform of the Belgian army somewhere near the front. Even if he had remained at the house, it was known German soldiers would go door to door to take males of working age or boys who were on the cusp of manhood. They always took the men, leaving only the women, children, and elderly. Women were considered easy to control. They would do as they were told and not fight back. Trudging along the path to their house in a row, where each identical three-story dwelling was joined to the next, Eleanor at once dropped her bag and ran ahead.
"Polo! Polo!"
She fell to her knees and enveloped the rough-haired hound with her arms. "Polo, you're here!" An elderly neighbour came to explain that Thomas had left the dog with her, but Polo ran back to the house as soon as she opened the door to let him out, and then sat on the doorstep, waiting. She held out money Thomas had provided for the dog's keep. After the woman was thanked time and again, Eleanor turned to her mother.
"I wonder if Papa will come home now?"
"Linny, we're tired. Let's all go inside the house."
Perhaps it was the look in her mother's eyes, or a strange echo that seemed to reverberate through their home, but in that moment, Eleanor DeWitt knew she would never see her father again, would never hear him call out to his daughters, "Where are my Amazons? Where's my Ceci and my little Linny?" She knew her father was dead. The years of Belgium's occupation would be seared into Eleanor's memory, as if she had been branded with time's hot iron. They were years of brutality, not just toward individual citizens, but whole villages of elderly men, women, and children who were gunned to death or funneled into a church which was then blown into the heavens. In one case, all because an old lady had answered back to a German soldier. The news of such terror travelled, embedding fear in the populace. Eleanor would never forget that time of want, of always being hungry, despite sporadic success with vegetables grown in the garden. They were the years of not knowing when it might all end, years when her mother seemed to say time and again, "Well, life has to go on." Yes, life had to go on. There was no other choice. A table with a paltry meal of boiled turnip and perhaps a slice of dry bread had become their staple diet, with meat being the stuff of dreams. Dreams where family gathered amid laughter and joy to sup at the table of plenty. Now there was never enough. And as time passed, enough became smaller and smaller, a living nightmare. Yet life went on. Before the war, the DeWitt girls had enjoyed a good education at the British Academy, but with its closure in 1914 they were enrolled at the convent, where the nuns ensured young women were immersed in an education that combined academic excellence with a strong moral and spiritual code. Before he left for the front, Thomas had settled funds with the nuns to ensure the continuation of his daughter's education. From Monday to Friday, Eleanor and Cecily walked a mile to the convent and were directed by their mother to come straight home after classes. They were not to engage in conversation with German soldiers or do anything to attract their attention. If her daily round took her to the market, Charlotte would accompany them to and from school. Though as queues at the baker and butcher grew longer with every passing week, she spent more time each day standing in a line. Eleanor grew tall. In 1916, when she reached the age of 12 and Cecily 15, she was only an inch below her sister in height, though at that point she retained the features of childhood, whereas Cecily had the demeanour of a woman. The family had become a tight trio, looking out for one another, staying home as much as possible. Charlotte knew what happened to young girls when soldiers were in the streets, so she kept her daughters as close as she could. The doors were locked and bolted every night and throughout much of the day. Their only fortune was money Thomas had left in the house, hidden, squirreled away. For their safety, only Charlotte knew where it was, and she never carried any more than a woman should be seen with as she paid for constables at the market or the bakery. It was harder to turn diamonds into currency or food for the table. But later that year, Eleanor noticed a change in her mother during the course of just one day. Charlotte returned from a visit to the market, and over a cup of weak tea, she told Eleanor and Cecily that she had met another woman, someone she had noticed once before as she went about her daily round. "She seemed very nice, though, as I said, I've only once seen her in the market," said Charlotte. "I was quite surprised when she approached me and began to talk about the weather and asked about my family, as if she knew who I was." "So what did you say?" asked Cecily, lifting the cup to her lips but not taking a sip. "I told her my daughters were still in school and that you were both doing well. She asked your names and said how lovely it must be to have two almost grown daughters." "Was that it?" asked Eleanor, convinced there must be more. There was something about her mother's demeanour that unsettled Eleanor. Charlotte seemed excited, yet she was speaking as if pacing herself, choosing her words with care. "I told her that, all things considered, I was grateful my girls are still enjoying a good education and keeping up with their studies. Of course, I informed her you'd had to leave the British Academy when it closed due to the German invasion, but I let her know that your father paid the nuns in advance for your lessons. I mean, we can't have people thinking we're accepting charity." "Oh, Mama, you are so English at times," observed Cecily. "Did you tell her the nuns are really strict with us, and we get weak potato and leek soup for lunch?" Eleanor stared at her sister. This did not seem the time for more snippy comments. "Well," said Charlotte, "I told her you did not care for the convent school, but you were learning your subjects well. Mind you, I also told her my eldest daughter would soon complete her studies. She was not sure what kind of work might suit her. Yet she would have to earn her keep." "Oh, here we go," thought Eleanor, glancing at Cecily as her mother made the pointed remark. Fortunately, Charlotte did not see her older daughter roll her eyes. The issue of Cecily taking up employment drew the conversation to a close, but later, over a simple supper of soup and bread, Eleanor noticed that her mother appeared distracted, as if every thought were fabric to be turned over and inspected for flaws before purchase. A few minutes later, Charlotte leaned forward and continued recounting the conversation with her new acquaintance. "Just as I was about to go on my way, she asked me if she could visit us here, you know, at the house, and..." "Here, she wants to come here?" asked Cecily. "I haven't finished yet, my dear. I've told you it's rude to interrupt. Anyway, she whispered to me that there were ways of showing the Germans that they made a grave error when they assumed poor little Belgium could not fight back." Charlotte looked around as if checking they were alone in their own home, then leaned forward to continue the story. "She said to me, right there on the corner of the street, 'Mrs. DeWitt, we Belgian women are strong. We prove how resourceful we are every time we put food on the table.'" Charlotte's eyes were wide, as if she were telling a tale of suspense to children. "And she told me there are ways to show that we are a force to be reckoned with. That's strange, said Cecily. Charlotte shrugged. I thought so too. I said I didn't really understand what she meant.
And what did she say then?
Asked Eleanor. Charlotte's eyes widened. Well, she said, I think you do, Mrs. DeWitt. And then she told me her name was Isabel.
Is that all she said? That sounds even more odd, said Cecily.
Charlotte shook her head.
No, there was more. She said, we know only too well, don't we, Mrs. DeWitt, that womanhood starts when childhood ends, and in wartime childhood ends early. Then she turned around and nodded toward the line of women outside the bakery. She pointed out that the old ladies elbowing to keep their place in the queue knew, perhaps more than any invading army, that when a woman rose up to prove her mettle, she claimed a power that would be hers until her dying day. She paused.
So, what do you think?
Eleanor laughed.
She's right. The old ladies really do elbow everyone out of the way.
Charlotte DeWitt glanced from one daughter to the other.
I thought she was interesting, so I invited her to come to the house to talk to us. She said it would be an early visit, but she turned around and went off down the street, so I don't know if she meant soon or early in the morning.
You invited her here, said Cecily.
Yes, we hardly see anyone at home anymore. Charlotte paused. And I confess, I was also curious. She intrigued me with the prospect of doing something more for our country, though I cannot think what on earth it could be.
Eleanor stared at her mother and sister as they sat in silence, and knew that, like her, they were indeed considering what this Isabel woman might have meant, and why she wanted to speak to them.
Oh, I nearly forgot this part, continued Charlotte. Before she went on her way, she touched my arm and said, Do you know the legend of the fall of the Hohenzollern dynasty in the lands of our invaders? Of course, I shook my head. I hadn't a clue what she was talking about.
Eleanor leaned toward her mother.
I know what it is. How do you know?
Said Cecily.
Sister Jean-Marie told us the story a week ago. It's that the fall of the dynasty would be heralded by the appearance of a woman wearing white. The Hohenzollerns are German. I think the German Kaiser might be related to them. It was something like that.
Yes, that's about the measure of it, said Charlotte.
Anyway, Isabel said it was interesting, given our name, which means white. And you know that was my name before I married your father. She said she would see us soon, and I didn't have to tell her where we lived. She knew.
She regarded her daughters for a few seconds, and then changed the subject.
Cecily Linney, I want to talk to you.
Charlotte DeWitt held an oil lamp to illuminate the way as she entered her daughter's bedroom and sat on Cecily's bed. Before the war, Charlotte had often felt as if she were her daughter's contemporary, but now fear had worn her down. Fear for her husband and concern for her girls, both terrors compounded by a dread that she might never see her home again. Yes, home was Belgium, but for the Englishwoman an ache had grown for the land of her birth, and war had rendered it so far away. Eleanor loved to hear the story of how her parents met. Charlotte White was 21 years of age when she stepped off the boat in Zeebrugge, excited to take up her new employment as governess to the children of a wealthy British businessman. She met Thomas DeWitt in Bruges while walking along the street. Attempting to put up her umbrella in a sudden squall, Charlotte almost poked the gangly Thomas in the eye as he passed. She thought later that he might have stepped into her path on purpose and even feigned injury as he held his hand to his face. Yet love soon followed the encounter. After several months of walking out together, they travelled to London to meet her family, where Thomas asked Charlotte's father for her hand. Raymond White had one request, informing Tomar that while he would not lay down a condition to his consent, he and his wife would very much like the couple to spend a reasonable period of time in England after their marriage to see if they might settle. 2 years of residence in the city followed, Tomar having found employment with a diamond merchant in London's Hatton Garden. But home beckoned for the young man, and Charlotte was keen to return to life on the continent, so they crossed the English Channel and settled in the small town not far from Antwerp. Now, following the departure of her beloved husband and the German invasion of her adopted country at 40 years of age, Charlotte no longer had the abundance of confidence and joy that had been a hallmark of her character. Yet as she sat on the bed framed in low light, Eleanor could see that her mother's bearing had changed, as if her old strength of spirit had been rekindled.
"Girls," she whispered, "we have a task."
"Why are you whispering, Mama?"
asked Cecily, rubbing her eyes.
"Because walls have ears, and we have neighbours, Ceci. We can trust no one."
"Not even Ceci, dear, do please listen."
Cecily and Eleanor were silent, while Charlotte reminded them about the meeting with a woman named Isabel. She had seen her again, and during their conversation, Isabel had repeated that there was more they could do for their country.
"Why didn't you tell us all this at supper?" asked Cecily.
"Because I had to think about it. I wasn't sure."
"We could be like the Three Musketeers," offered Eleanor.
Charlotte nodded, smiling.
"Yes, like the Three Musketeers." She took a breath. "So, what do you say?"
"Yes,"
said Eleanor.
"Yes," said Cecily.
"Then when she comes to the house first thing in the morning, I will not turn her away. Your father has been gone for 2 years now, and I can endure the waiting no longer. We must play a part in Belgium's fortunes, however simple the task set before us."
Charlotte kissed each daughter on the forehead.
"I miss Papa and Polo," said Eleanor.
"Yes, me too," said Charlotte.
"Very, very much."
She left the room, closing the door without a sound.
"She had to do it, Linny. We couldn't keep Polo. There's no food for us, so she had to take him to Arthur." "I hope Arthur was kind."
"Polo didn't feel a thing."
"I hope Papa didn't feel a thing."
"Go to sleep, Linny. We have to be downstairs in the kitchen early, and you know how I hate mornings."
Indeed, Eleanor understood only too well how much her sister hated mornings. It was a struggle to rouse her in time to walk to the convent for the start of lessons.
"What do you think this Isabel woman will say? What does she want us to do?"
"Probably steal food from the nuns. Now go to sleep. I'm tired." Eleanor and her sister sat on either side of their mother at the table and stared at the woman who called herself Isabel. Eleanor would not have been able to offer an explanation for her doubt, but she had a distinct feeling that the woman was not an Isabel. She couldn't imagine what name might suit her, but it wasn't the one she was using. Eleanor judged the woman to be younger than their mother. Perhaps she was 25, 26 or thereabouts, though it was hard to estimate age anymore, because anyone who wasn't a child seemed old. Isabel was of average height, and her clothing was no better or worse than anyone else's. She was thin, though everyone seemed thin since the occupation. When her mother put her arms around Eleanor and wished her sweet dreams before she went to bed, Eleanor could feel bone against bone, as if her mother's ribs might become entangled with her own, and they would never be able to snap apart. The visitor wore her dark, almost black hair drawn back in a chignon, topped with a brimmed hat that shielded her face. Her skin was clear, but her pallor grey. Her skirt skimmed above her ankles, and her boots were worn but polished. She wore a navy blue woolen jacket that fell to her thighs, with a cotton blouse revealing a frill at the neck, secured with a nondescript pin. If the woman had ever owned a brooch, it might well have been sold by now. Eleanor could see that Isabel would never stand out in a crowd and could even pass a German soldier without him taking a second glance or asking to see her papers. She would be viewed as a Belgian nobody. The tasks you will be assigned at this point are not difficult, though discretion is crucial, explained Isabel. She took a map from underneath a sheet of newspaper in her shopping bag, on top of which a couple of less than fresh potatoes languished. She spread the map on the table and tapped her forefinger on a place where the women knew the river ran close to the railway line, overlooked by a meadow that rose up to a hill, commanding a clear view of the railway line in both directions. Closer to the railway, a path ran alongside, interspersed with stands of deciduous trees, some overhanging the tracks. It was a place where lovers met, where children would play in summer, and which would draw ramblers on a fine day. I would suggest a walk along the path here, not the one along by the railway, but this one leading up to the top of the hill. You are taking the fresh air, bring a blanket, and sit for a while. Do the girls have paper, and perhaps coloured pencils, a set of paints? Draw the trees, the landscape, stay together. As each train passes along this railway line, count the carriages. Count the flat rolling stock if you see anything mounted on top, a gun carriage, for example. Make a note of the time when you observe the train. That is all I need. Go to church tomorrow and afterward for your walk. Return to your home by 4 o'clock, when I will come to join you for tea. She smiled. I know, don't worry, I will supply the tea. A few seconds' hiatus followed, as if Isabel were leaving the air pure for the DeWitt women to absorb her instructions. Charlotte opened her mouth to speak, but seemed to think better of it. Isabel continued, making eye contact with her audience. Do not tell anyone about this meeting. When I leave, wave to me as if I were your friend. Thank me for the potatoes. Do not keep an account of your task anywhere in this house. She stared at Cecily. Do not write in your diary, if you have one, and do not tell your friends. Eleanor suspected Isabel could see into her sister's mind. She glanced at her mother, who had cleared her throat to speak.
Why us, Isabel? Why have you come to us?
It's not just you, Mrs. DeWitt. Women across our country are being asked to serve in this way. Any one of your neighbours along the street might also be assisting. But they will never tell you, nor must you tell them. If your instructions change, it will be me who informs you. She paused. And at that moment, young Eleanor thought she could see a fire amid the weariness in Isabel. Perhaps it was the same flame that had reignited her mother's confidence. We have no choice, Mrs. DeWitt. The Germans do not suspect women of working against them. They see us standing for hours in long queues to provide for our young and our elders. They see us doing our best to try to live our lives. And they see us withdraw into our lairs while under the threat of their violence. She smiled. They have no idea what we are capable of inflicting upon them. Charlotte nodded. Will you do what I have asked of you? Eleanor felt her mother take her hand and saw her reach toward Cecily on her other side. As if by instinct, all three women leaned toward one another and nodded. Yes, Charlotte, Cecily, and Eleanor DeWitt replied in unison. Eleanor thought of her father, of the man she had held on to before he left the house, until finally he had to take her arms and pull them away as if releasing himself from the tentacles of an octopus. Come, Linny, be brave. We shall all be home together soon. You must be a help to your mother now. You have much to do. And I will see you again soon, I promise. She hoped Papa would be proud of his women folk. She hoped this visitor would give her a chance to make a good account of herself.